When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Hey, everybody. I'm excited about our chat coming up with Sarah Payne. She was first introduced to medical marijuana during her treatment for stage 3 colon cancer. Cannabis is what got her through her initial illness, the surgery, as well as chemo. And today, she's an award-winning educator specializing in cancer-related symptom management and an activist for normalizing medical cannabis. We're excited about the conversation with Sarah Payne coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the podcast. It's so great to have you here. It's nice to flip the script a little bit. Last time I was in your neck of the woods, having to get grilled on cannabis by Sarah Payne. But it was a lot of fun. We had a great time. It was very nice meeting you and getting a chance to chat about the industry, what's happening, where things are going, and what are some of the big policy and political issues, quite frankly, that you know many of the voices and leaders inside the industry are having to deal with. Let's kind of tell us a little bit about your story and coming into this space, which was very interesting, and it'll kind of help folks sort of get some grounding of where you're coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. And it's always a treat to talk with you. So
yeah.
if you told me 12 years ago that I would be working in cannabis, I would tell you you were nuts. I was working in downtown San Francisco, working in nonprofits, and a majority of my nonprofit work was in civil rights. When I was 37, I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. And my mom is a cancer researcher. Actually, she just recently retired. She's mm-hmm. a hematology oncology nurse. So she did the clinical trials on the chemo that I ended up taking during that time, like years earlier.
Right.
And because of her, I knew that cannabis would help me with, you know, nausea, you know, appetite. Although she'll say, I never told you to use cannabis. I told you
to Mom, use- I never told you to go to drugs. I just told you to go out in the backyard and grab some weeds.
That's right. And you know, one of the things that I noticed when I got my card, she was doing research in Baylor. In Dallas, and I went to go see her. And of course, you don't travel with cannabis. So I actually ended up taking a pharmaceutical form of synthesized THC with me to help me right after chemo, because I'd get unhooked, go visit her. And it was actually didn't work. And it felt really awful.
Right.
And so cannabis for me at that time helped me to not have to take drugs that would create more complications with my treatment, which was wonderful. And it's not to say that I hadn't experimented with it before, because I certainly had, but I never looked at it medicinally. And then, you know, when you go through something huge like cannabis cancer, it changes the way you look at the world. Mm-hmm. And I had decided after my treatment that going back to the office wasn't the choice for me, and that I wanted to go back to school, figure out what I wanted to do. I was going to go for my master's in org psych. And the dispensary that I work for now, actually, I became really good friends with the CEO, because I wrote some letters to Department of Public Health on behalf of medical patients around policy. And so he asked me if I wanted a job, and I said, sure, I'll stay with you for 4 years while I'm in grad school. And we're going on year 11. And since then, I'm the public education officer for the Apothecarium dispensaries, which are owned by TerrAscend. And I was the one of the co-chairs for the legalization task force for San Francisco for 3 years. And now I'm on oversight committee. And I also am on steering committee for Americans for Safe Access. But my love is my podcast Planted, because mm-hmm. I get to talk to people like you and people in the industry, and really about all the different things, every different way that it touches it with an educational leaning, because conversation is normalization. And when we're looking at policies now, it's wonderful that we're seeing legalization in a lot of states, or we're seeing the idea that it may be coming to states, but we're still not basing policy necessarily on fact. We're doing it on state culture, which is really strong, and stigma. And so now it's time for people to get educated, to get active. If there was ever a time to get civically activated, it's now. And it's not just about cannabis, but it can be a really great way of teaching people how they can make a difference in their local and national government.
So let's parse that a little bit, because you wrote a great piece back in December about education in cannabis, and it was entitled, and folks, you can catch it in Rolling Stone at rollingstone.com, Why Cannabis Education Could Create Better Policy. And you really dive into two very distinct pieces of the cannabis discussion. One being policy, right? Just generally, okay, so how do we regulate this? What do we do with this? And stigma, for example, where there are a lot of attitudes that have been around for 100 years in this space, you know, sort of a 1920s, 1930s view of, you know, getting high and, you know,
Reefer madness
and all of that. And you really try to bring into clarity the necessity for developing enlightened policies in a way that informs not just the policymakers, but the public, breaks down a lot of the stigmas. Talk about that, because it is particularly important in understanding the policy differences between medicinal use and recreational use. And more states are now beginning to open the door to recreational use. And that's where you start to hear this sort of commingling of misunderstanding, where they project their attitudes about someone who just wants to have a joint when they get home from work versus grandma who needs a joint to dull the pain or deal with issues related to pain and health in her particular recovery regimen.
Right. Well, there's a lot to do around education for bridging the gap on knowledge to create good policy, right? I do, as somebody who has over 18,000 hours of experience with human beings in cannabis, I've seen the gamut with people using it medicinally, people using it just to kick back.
Right.
And we have to have a conversation about all of it. We, you know, there's the idea of safe access for patients, because people are actually able to use cannabis in lieu of other pharmaceuticals that could create more harm. Like in my case, when I was going through chemo.
Right.
And you've got people who should have access to safe, good product just because they want to relax. And there's just a lot to be said in between both of those things. So if we have good policy in our states, everyone has access to safe product, because the only time, you know, people talk about, you know, it being a gateway drug. You and I talked about this on the podcast, right. No one's going to be using cannabis and thinking crack sounds like a great idea. Let's do that. You know?
No, they're not.
They're not. And when we're looking at the recreational side as well, a lot of people, and don't get me wrong, I like a nice glass of wine as much as anyone. I'm very close, you know, I'm in the Bay Area, so I'm close to
Yes, you do wine.
You know, but a lot of people have actually been able to curb their drinking, which has a lot worse side effects, by using cannabis as an alternative for stress management. Because even when we're using it recreationally, whether it's called medicinal or recreational, it's a substance that creates a reaction in the body. And we want to make sure that we're educating the public to figure out what works well for them.
Right.
But also we want to be educating our, you know, our policymakers on the fact that if we don't have a good foundation for policy, we're not going to have safe product on the market, and that cannabis has never killed anybody on its own. But what we have had is people with compromised immune systems getting cannabis off the market or in the black market because they couldn't afford it in the dispensaries, and it could be rich in mildews, molds, funguses, heavy metals, pesticides, and with a compromised immune system that can kill you. And even if you don't have that, it's a harmful thing to be putting into your body. So we need to look at, especially in California, our taxation is so incredibly high that people are turning to the black market to get product. And in turn, the state is frustrated because they're saying, hey, we're not getting all the taxes we thought we were when we, you know, created this taxation. And the bottom line is, if we had lower taxes, not only would people purchase, but ultimately the government would be making more money because there would be more purchases in the legal market.
Well, it's just amazing that here we are having a conversation about lowering taxes on cannabis. You know, just, you know, as a Republican who likes to lower taxes, that's a space one would never think to find themselves. But it's an important space because it does speak a great deal to how markets are created in the first place, and specifically black markets. And if you want to avoid that as a long-term underground problem, then you have to strike the right balance between what the market can bear in terms of tax on cannabis and govern, or not govern, but place that policy in the proper place and context with the voters out there and with the people who use it, so that they will actually, as you say, participate in that market. Because otherwise, if you put a 300% tax on something, guess what? I'm not using it.
No,
I'm just going to go someplace. I got Bobo in the back who give me a hookup when it comes in the warehouse, and I'll just get it from Bobo. I'll slip Bobo $20, $30, $50, and I can get it, get what I need. So you make an excellent point about that understanding of how these policies, when they're implemented, actually play out. And how they also inform the public, how they may play a role in educating the public in the long run. What would be a proper form of cannabis education, in your view, as states are now looking to broaden this conversation, as we are here in Maryland, they continue to do in places like California, but as we now see in the Deep South, in the Midwest, the same move in this direction. How would you look at those types of policies and connect that education dot for people out there?
I think that education not only has to happen in the form of public education, where we're looking at, you know, working with Department of Public Health and putting together educational programs, or just even, you know, ads that they do for education. But the big problem, the disconnect with that, is that a lot of times we're not getting appropriate education on the policy side or on the public side, because they're worried about getting biased information. So you have to really look at who your educator is. Like me, with my education, my work with policy, I don't have skin in the game. I'm not looking to make a lot of money by selling a product and giving people information so that they purchase that product. Mm-hmm. I'm having conversations about, everybody reacts differently to cannabis. Let's create a safe container for experimentation and let me show you how. Let's do the basic conversations on the different ways of using cannabis, how it metabolizes in each individual's body, and also looking at talking to companies about, let's not say that this is a calm formula, because for somebody, it could be something that makes them a little crazy. Like when we were talking my podcast about having that Tylenol moment, we have to talk about all the good things that happen, but also the things that we need to be careful about, because cannabis is not a panacea. And a lot of the work that I do with policymakers is really cutting through all of that, having real talk, because An unfortunate part of my work is there are some people that are really excited about cannabis, but they fail to understand that there are things that we have to take into consideration. And even though we create our own endogenous cannabinoids in our body, we have an endocannabinoid system, not all of us can tolerate phytocannabinoids, which is what we find in cannabis, like THC, CBD, all of that. And talking about drug interactions and talking about the fact that, you know, as with anything, we're walking chemistry experiments as human beings, and we're all really different. And I also think that having the conversation with policymakers about the human side of cannabis, how it's affecting people, how it's creating jobs. But here's something for you, Michael. We talk about all the jobs that cannabis has created for people, getting people working in, getting people engaged in things that they may not have even considered. Young people are looking at things like supply chain management,
right,
culture, biochemistry that may not have before. But when they get these great jobs, they don't qualify for an FHA loan if they want to buy a house.
Right, right, right. Exactly. Because the federal government has not caught up in its policy with respect to this product. Not just how to regulate it, but tax it and integrate it into the economy, the banking system, et cetera. So you see those realities. As we, one of the things you and I talked about when I visited Planted, the idea that you've got, again, this the medicinal recreational use, you've got these ideas about both of those right now. Why do you think these stigmas and these this hesitancy towards cannabis persists? You see it play out. You hear members of Congress talk about it as if, you know, it is some foreign thing from another world, unbeknownst to man and woman, you know, that, you know, will harm and kill and devastate communities, when we know the science tells us that's not the case. But there is this stigma, there is this hesitancy. What do you think attributes to that?
Well, Hearst, DuPont, and Anslinger did a great job with their work turning people against cannabis back in the day. And the thing that we really need to talk about, and some of us are, I do for Black History Month, I always do a class on cannabis history, because it really talks about how a lot of these policies were racist.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking to target a particular, you know, group of people. And then you have people like the DuPonts, who hemp was actually, you know, it was going to compete with plastics. And then we have our own William Randolph Hearst.
Right.
Who, you know, he was into lumber, and hemp was, you know, going to definitely compete with that. So what we're looking at was competition and racism, because the AMA.
That still seems to be the order of the day today.
Yes.
Still very much at the core of the cannabis discussion.
That's
competition and racism.
Yeah. And even though, like I said before, it's not a panacea, a lot of the issues that we're having with the environment, with industrial things, would have never happened had we been using a lot of hemp products. Like, I don't know if you know this, but like Henry Ford had a car that was made from hemp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so these are the issues that we deal with. I mean, our Declaration of Independence, one of the drafts was written on hemp paper, not the declaration itself, like some people like to say, but one of the drafts. It's been an integral part of our country for years, as far as industry and also the things that we used it for medicine. And now people are coming back to it, and they're having these revelations like, oh, it's good for this. Oh, it's good for that. Well, guess what? A lot of people knew that a long time ago, before we went into prohibition.
So how do we now today, we like to think of ourselves as much more enlightened than our forefathers and mothers, forebears. And certainly on subjects like this, we tend to look through a somewhat distorted view, lens rather, at times, where we only see certain things and not the entire picture. And that's particularly the case when looking at the issues around race and how that is a play in the industry, not just among those that are now trying to grab up licenses and things like that, but even among the industry itself and how they have over time dealt with some of the stigmas related to race inside the cannabis community. So what do you think both the community as a whole and policymakers who are shaping this policy should or can be doing to begin to address the levels of discrimination, deal with the social equity component that everyone is now hyped up on, but really not so much because as we're seeing play out, not every brother and sister is getting it. And a whole lot of folks are still in jail for having an ounce of weed, a decade ago. So how do you see those pieces as you talked about in your op-ed about bringing, you know, the education and the policy piece together? How do we do that in this sort of discrimination, social equity space?
I think what we really need to do is acknowledge the fact that education has been held back in a lot of these communities. People haven't had the opportunities to learn about, go to B school. I mean, get your MBA to be able to learn, you know, horticulture. A lot of these people haven't had the opportunities to have the privilege of education that a lot of us have. So we need to, and this is, you know, it's one of those phrases, level the playing field. We need to start creating opportunities for people to get scholarships and to have, like I taught one of the first cannabis classes at City College. That's an accessible institution for people to learn. And then, you know, go from there. Support equity brands, like really go vote with your wallet. People need to go to dispensaries and ask about equity brands. And also, you know, there's a lot of equity brands, I think, have a hard time getting into dispensaries because people are looking at things through the lens of privilege, where, you know, people are looking at the branding and everything. They're like, oh, that doesn't look like me. That doesn't feel like me. Well, guess what? People of color, Black people want to see products that represent
that them. Represent, and it's true most anything. So I was gonna, that sort of begs the question, how does the equity, the social equity piece play itself out in cannabis? I mean, why does it seem that in some regards, the people you would think most likely to get it don't seem to get it?
Why do Black and brown people have a really hard time getting loans for anything?
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing more companies.
Sort of the systemic nature of the way institutions are created and then sustained longer term.
Yeah. And when we're looking at there are some equity participants that have been very successful and have been really lucky to link up with wonderful people. We have some amazing activists out there doing a lot of the hard work, and I really applaud them. And we have people that are trying to get a foothold in equity, but we have people who are being predatory with them, larger companies that are saying, sure, you know, I'll support you, but I want 51% of your company.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they find themselves locked out of their businesses and out in the cold. So we have to close those loopholes as well and figure out ways for people to be able to be sustainable, have access to resources that aren't going to turn on them.
Right.
And also having the conversation about generational wealth and how to create assets that can be passed down from generation to generation, because that's something that in many ways is lacking in these communities. I mean, when we look at like San Francisco and what happened to the Fillmore and people getting their houses taken away from them by eminent domain, those were things that they could have passed on to their families that could have been used as equity to start businesses.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. And it really kind of, it begs for me the next question then, because is this really something that policymakers can foster and promote to help reduce discrimination and sort of address the social equity piece? Or is this something that becomes a practicum in the industry itself, where by virtue of a general mindset, an ideology, if you will, and practical application and engagement, the community is the one that will set that standard. So you have a choice. We can, as a community in the cannabis space, began to address holistically and directly systemic racism and social inequity in our industry, such as it is growing, or we can wait to be told how to do that by state and federal policymakers?
I think it's both. I think we have to start here and now in our community and in our industry mm-hmm. and make change. And I think from a policy standpoint, it should happen as well. Like in San Francisco, you know, we have to participate in some way, shape, or form in equity to get our licensure. And we have to report on it every year. And I think it's something that we should really be doing because we should be lifting each other up as a community.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there should be more things around training, tax breaks, fast tracking and permitting for equity businesses, but also getting the community involved with mentorship programs and helping people with their brands, because we have a lot of really talented people that are coming from the black market that need to get other skill sets that they may not have had access to.
Right.
A lot of privileged people in the cannabis industry that have a lot of access to not only education, but connections that they could actually help, because networking and education are what it's all about, being able to succeed in this, right? It's not always what you know, but who you know. But in cannabis, it should be both. Like, we should be having people, you know, you have a problem with working with like Metric, you should be able to talk to somebody that will help you through it, because it's a headache for everybody. If you have somebody who wants to start a business and they're looking to get funding, there should be some sort of way, like we have incubators that are helping with that.
Right.
Like business plans and where to go for grants. And even like on the oversight committee, we've been talking about the grants in California that are going out to equity businesses. And one of the things that we made as a recommendation was that the equity operator needed to own 51% or more of their business to get the entire amount, because otherwise we're giving that grant money not just to the equity person, but to somebody who could actually screw them over.
We're having a great conversation with Sarah Pan. She is an award-winning educator and activist in both the cancer and the cannabis space. We're going to continue our great conversation after this break. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Harry Littman, former United States attorney, current LA Times legal affairs columnist, and creator and host of the Talking Feds podcast, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day, from voting rights.
Voting in our country has a specific racial connotation and a racial history, and one in which it has been fundamentally about moving away from exclusion and at a snail's pace.
To the January 6th Select Committee.
We're going to see almost every actor who's culpable in this refuse the subpoena.
To U.S. national security and foreign relations.
I served in the FBI in the aftermath of 9/11, and I've seen what happens when there's boots on the ground.
To anything and everything at the Department of Justice.
The hardest thing about coming into the Department of Justice, it's not like everything hits reset. There are court proceedings and investigations that are all midstream, and you don't control when you get to make a decision on those.
To hear roundtable discussions with the country's most prominent voices from government, journalism, and law. Follow us wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele and enjoying very much my reconnect with Sarah Pan, who is really, she's not your typical activist per se. She's really honed in on the education in the cannabis space and making people aware of so many aspects and feature of the industry as a whole, the products, the science, the biology, which, you know, a lot of times we kind of look at these things, Sarah, and it's all one shot. It's all about the cash, or it's all about, you know, the restrictions that the government will put on it. It's all about the taxes. It's all, But what I appreciate about what you are doing and what you do with your podcast, she is the host, by the way, of the podcast Planted with Sarah Payne, which I appeared, by the way. So check out my appearance on her podcast as you listen to her appearance on mine. But you really try to square it out, you know, to sort of let's figure out where the four corners are here and really begin to understand what we're working with as this industry is growing. One of the things that we talked about on your podcast and that I tried to make a pretty big deal about when I was at a cannabis convention a few years ago, ArcView, was this the idea of the responsibility the industry has right now to bring the American people along in this process, to make sure that people understand that this is not, you know, an industry of potheads who don't give a damn about children having access to cannabis or, you know, pushing out propaganda for the sake of raking in cash. That's not been my experience in talking with enlightened and intelligent people like yourself who are steadfastly, you know, making the case in front of policymakers about the industry. Where do you see it right now as more states are coming online? People, as we noted, are starting to evolve into people, states, into recreational use. Where do you see the industry right now in the mind's eye of the country?
I see a lot of people really excited, and I see a lot of people really nervous. And what I always say to that is, I use the hashtag conversation is normalization.
Right.
Because people, when I've talked to people, whether it's a policymaker or a member of the public, what changes their mind is having the conversation with somebody else to see the impact that it's had on their life. Whether it's the cancer survivor that used it to get through their ordeal, or they have a family member or a friend who started a cannabis business and they start to understand, oh, there's so much more to it than I could ever possibly have thought.
Right.
Because it's about stigma. And also, you know, we're getting some good studies that are coming out, especially around stuff with like youth access. The thing that we hear the most when we're looking at, you know, policy is, you know, what about the children? And, you know, on oversight committee, we have somebody from the Unified School District down there. So we have these conversations. Right. And what we're finding is that in areas where there's legalization, kids aren't interested in cannabis, because all of a sudden when it's legalized and they know that their aunt or their parents are partaking, right, it's no longer fun. It's no longer something that they shouldn't be doing. So they're feeling, you know, curious about it and doing it. And the fact of the matter is that when we have, you know, established brick and mortar, I can't tell you how many times I've had somebody come into the store, very much obviously a senior, doesn't have their ID and gets so mad that we can't let them in. And it's like, yes, right, I know.
I know you're a senior, baby, but it's like when you go to a restaurant and you order certain states, certain restaurants, you order booze, you got to show an ID.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there at the table, I'm like, now, do I look like I'm under 18? And the hostess or the waitress or waiter just laughs and goes, no, what's your ID? You know, you get it. I mean, I get it, grandma, I get it. But you need the ID to get in the store. So, but that's, what does that say though about the social consciousness of those proprietors and those in the industry, that they're not willing to take the risk and let grandma in the store with in violation of state law that requires that they check her ID when she comes in. Now, I'm not a numbnut. I know nothing's absolute, and there's someone out there who's skirting the rules and the laws and not doing it the right way. But it's kind of, Sarah, goes to, I guess, the falsehoods and the myths about the industry that may still persist today, that these are people who are on the wrong side of the law by virtue of the product that they sell or the product that they use. How do you address that, and how do you beat back on those falsehoods? What are some of the falsehoods that still exist about cannabis today?
But, well, one, that there hasn't been enough research done on cannabis. Cannabis has been used for thousands of years.
Thousands of years. I mean, folks, cavemen use cannabis, okay? The moment they figured out, once they figured out fire, cannabis was not far behind.
It's true. Well, and what we're finding is that as far as cultivation, that may be one of the earliest things that we cultivated. And we're not sure if we found it or it found us.
Right, right.
It goes anywhere.
Right.
So, you know, you have that, but you also, there is.
I'm sorry, you just made, I'm not, this is so rude. I just had a moment when you said, whether we found it or it found us, you know, particularly out in your neck of the woods where every season there's these fires, right? And I can imagine back in the day, a field of cannabis, of marijuana just kind of burning, yeah? It's just, and little caveman sitting there going, why do I feel so good about this fire?
Right?
I'm sorry. But I mean, then they figured out, oh, that's what this does. But no, go ahead and make your point. I'm just sorry. I'm just being silly.
Oh, no.
But it just occurred to me when you said that.
That was the first hot boxing.
Exactly. Okay. So, there is obviously a very high level of seriousness around it. And you make a good point that, you know, some of the falsehoods is that, you know, it's not an industry that's serious about the science. It's not studied. We still don't know what it will do and all of these types of things. But we also know that there's some really good narratives that can come out of this product in terms of how it does help people, and those aren't myths. That's real. You can touch it. And a lot of people know they see it from their grandparents or a cousin or a relative or a friend who are using it. People who know your story and were part of that story know the impact, you know, it had on you. So there are living examples, real life examples that refute some of the falsehoods. True?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it can take some time for people to see it and understand it. But if you're paying attention and you're seeing what people are doing, I mean, okay, let's be honest. There will always be bad players in any
market. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But the majority of people who are working in cannabis are doing it because it's affected their lives significantly. They're just fascinated by it and they want to get involved in something new and different,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they're looking at the fact of how much prosperity it can bring. The green rush is over. Straight up.
Thank you. I agree. So tell folks what that is.
So you're not going to go into cannabis and make a ton of money. You're not. And if you're investing in cannabis, you better be looking at the long game. Don't invest in it and a year later ask where my money is.
I actually had that conversation recently with someone. Like, I'm sorry, bro. You should have read the, it wasn't fine print, it was bold print. But go ahead. You make a good point. People have this notion, just come in and you know, 6 months later, I'm going to be a gazillionaire.
Yeah, it's not. If you wanted to do that, you should have gone in when it was going for, you know, $3,500 a pound when you were worried about the feds coming in.
Right.
That's when you should have done it if you're looking at a green rush. Because the reason that we made so much money back then was that there was a lot of risk. Now we're looking at taxation. Like in California, we have all these beautiful taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a glut of cannabis that's going for lower and lower and people aren't making money and they're starting to close their businesses. We're looking at major extinction events we have for the past 3 years.
Really? So it's progressed that much from the early days. Interesting.
Yeah. And it's, you know, because we have, and it's good. We need to have a foundation. We need to have rules around testing. We need to have rules around packaging. Although I think that, you know, it's excessive and it's kind of everyone proof.
Right. Is that sort of the normalization of the market? Would you say that's kind of the normalization of the cannabis market? Guess what? We're now big boys and girls. We're competing with the Wall Streeters and the Main Streeters. So we're kind of in that space.
Yeah, well, but you know, I mean, here's the thing too, Michael. I've yet to see a childproof cap on a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah,
fair you know, point. And honestly, if we really want to get to brass tacks about it, nobody smokes a joint and goes home and beats their kids.
Yeah, yeah, they don't. Fact.
I mean, if anything, I've heard people say it's a tool for me to like be able to handle everything.
I don't go home and act out on the family. No, those are some of the dynamics about it that are very fascinating to me in terms of how people process their move into cannabis. You know, I have friends who've used it since we were in high school together. I have other friends like myself who've never used it, but are very strong advocates and supporters of it because we understand the science, we understand the history, and we know, and I value more than anything else. So for me, the medicinal side of it. For me, the recreational piece is like, okay,
yeah,
I've been recreating forever. That's great. But the more important thing is the medicinal side and the impact I know for my own family members who suffer from ailments that are helped by cannabis. So the reality is, it's a very different reality now, I think, and you make the point so well. For those who are looking at this, it really is becoming, well, no, it is an industry. And as all industries, it is now settled into that space where markets are created, markets decline, markets go away. And that's what you're seeing playing out right now.
Yeah. And you're seeing a lot of MSOs coming into play. Mm-hmm. But I also think that there's room and there should be space for small producers that do artisan products, you know, because there is such, you know, we're getting some standardization of it, which is good and bad.
Right.
Because, you know, it's like years ago, I was in a research call where they were asking me, that this company had a big pharma client, and they said, do you think, and this was when we were in medical days, your patients would be okay with, you know, cannabis from big pharma? And I said, yes and no, because there are some people who look at that as like the institutionalization of cannabis. Like, okay, this is good. Like when, you know, when Gupta was on CNN with stuff around cannabis, I had this woman who was in her 90s call me. She's like, Dr. Gupta says it's okay. I'm going to come in and check it out. Great. It started the conversation.
Right.
But the thing that people need to know is that a lot of people use cannabis medicinally as an active choice against big pharma because they've had such bad experiences or the side effects, they haven't gotten what they needed. And I, that's not to say that there isn't, I don't think that we should be looking at getting rid of traditional medicine.
Right. But there's some real concerns, and one of them being addiction. It's a big concern for a lot of folks who do not want to become addicted to certain, you know, opioids or other types of medicines that are largely pushed by pharmaceutical companies. And this is not, folks, this is not Michael and Sarah saying this. Just turn on your damn television. And my favorite part in those commercials is when they start going through all the shit that's going to make you sick, die, crazy, whatever. And yet they're still pushing that. And so what I am curious about is how the industry kind of continues to evolve in this space, not fall into some of the traps that we've seen some other industries fall into in terms of at coming out of the gate, which begs the question, when you look at what we're doing here in the United States, how do we compare to other countries around the globe. Now, we know some have really hard and fast laws against marijuana, et cetera. But in the space where cannabis, like we see here in the US, has and is establishing markets, starting to be regulated, where are we comparatively?
Well, I think first we have to have a real discussion about the fact that the reason that cannabis has so much stigma in other countries is because of the work that we did around that. We did a lot of PR work around that policy-wise, pressuring countries to make cannabis illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to see how things are opening up. Like if you look at Thailand, it's opening up. They're starting to look at the idea of cannabis tourism. They actually have a lot of projects going on with hemp. But then alternatively, look at Amsterdam.
Which is sort of the quintessential playground for cannabis.
Right. But that's changing because the Netherlands, several years ago, they used to have it where medicinal cannabis could be covered by certain insurances, and they stopped that. And now they're looking at making it so that people who visit the country can't go to the coffee houses. So they're actually kind of going backwards in their policy.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's very different with the way things are going. But the one thing that I've noticed, like in places like Portugal, where they've decriminalized, you know, drug use and cannabis being included in that, mm-hmm. is that they're having a much easier time dealing with addiction. And, you know, we need to be having conversations in general when we're looking at substances that are addictive about harm reduction and the stigma around addiction, because a lot of times the reason that people have a hard time and have bad relationships with substances is because of shame and the lack of support, you know?
Yeah. How does your work touch on that? What are you doing, particularly given your own personal experience in that regard?
I've worked with a lot of people to help them curb and end their opiate use. I'm not a medical professional by any stretch of the imagination, but I make recommendations for things for people to try. So, you know, I've actually helped people that have had issues with heroin, with speed, with cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
As human beings, we're constantly subconsciously striving for homeostasis. Our thermostats might be a little off and we go beyond what it is that we need. But, you know, the reality is you can have a bad relationship with anything. Like when people say cannabis isn't addictive, well, it's not physically addictive, but we can become psychologically addicted. So like several years ago, I had a gentleman who came into the dispensary with a syringe of cannabis concentrate. And he said, I've been smoking this to get myself off of hard drugs and it's not working anymore. And he just gave me this really hard stare. And that's when I looked at him and I said, this is another conversation that you have to have. What hole are you trying to fill? Because this substance on its own starts the process.
Right.
Now we have to look at what else do you have to take out of your toolbox to get yourself into a healthy state? Is it therapy? Is it working with a physician on other modalities of therapies? What's going on? Because there is no one single thing that's going to cure everything. And as much as some of my colleagues will say that cannabis is that, it is not. It does a lot of great things, but we mm-hmm. have to be realistic about what it can and can't do.
And that's why I like talking to Sarah, folks, because she's realistic about this industry and its product and its people and how all of that works together. Or could not work together if we get it wrong. And so, Sarah, I really appreciate your stopping by to spend a little bit of time to talk about this and to further elevate the conversation and engage, my friends on this podcast in this conversation in a way that maybe having learned or heard something they didn't know before is always important. It's always a good lesson. And every time we chat, I pick up and learn a little bit more. So I'm really, really grateful for that and the leadership of your words and experience in this area, which is so important coming at it the way you do. So thank you.
Thank you. I think it's really important to talk with, everybody who is making policy to really get them to understand what it can and can't do and the reality of it and cut through all the stigma that is informing a lot of this policy that not only, you know, goes against prosperity, but actually can harm people in the industry. And I also think that it's a really good time to get people talking about, if you don't like the prices in your state, if you don't like the policies, it's time to come out of the cannabis closet. It's time to let your policymakers know, you know, you're a highly functioning member of society that contributes, you use cannabis, and you vote.
Bingo. And that last one is the thing that will get their attention more than anything else. The fact that you vote. No, it makes it such a good point. Sarah Payan, she's a real treat to learn from and to watch her do her work in the cannabis space. She is a leading, an award-winning educator and activist for medical cannabis, and a real strong voice in the movement in normalizing cannabis for use in health. And we really appreciate your taking a time to be with us. You can follow her on Twitter at Sarah M as in Mary Payan, P-A-Y-A-N. And check out her podcast, folks, again, to further the conversation and to continue to learn a little bit more about what's happening in this space. Check out Planted with Sarah Payan. It's a great podcast. I've had the privilege of being a part of it. And I think you would get a lot out of it. So again, that's what we like here in this neck of the woods, is to inform, educate, and engage. And you brought all of that today, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Michael. It's always a pleasure hanging out with you.
Oh my gosh, it's so much fun. And we didn't even smoke a joint. So I know my audience go, I got to go to the videotape and see if this brother's smoking over there. but anyway, no, it's all good. So folks, I really, again, appreciate you when you spend some time with us. You can find us on the Spreaker app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcast on. Please, if you like this episode, comment on the Spreaker app. It helps me know your thoughts and to bring some better conversations to you as we continue to grow and engage here at the Michael Steele Podcast. Until next time, be safe, be well. Spring is here, baby. Masks are coming off. Mandates are going away. It's a time for us to re-engage with one another and our humanity for and with each other. So enjoy. Until next time, I'm Michael Steele.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news? Weird politics, weird country, Facepalm America.
Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.